Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
It's their first interview.
And now your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow to experience their lives. And this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night, and it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artists First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. At this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. He's an award-winning author based in South Carolina. He's the author of 31 books, including Queenpins, Notorious Women Gangsters from the Modern Era, and the just-published Straight from the Hood, Amazing but True Gangster Tales. He's also the producer of two award-winning documentaries. Get out there and buy these books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed. Ron is also a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland documentary series and publisher of Strategic Media Books. Go to www.strategicmediabooks.com. Also, be sure to visit his website at ronchepsik.com. I'll spell you his last name, C-H-E-P-E-S-I-U-K. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio of my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, which is also my hometown, and he has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. This year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people in the Thunder Bay area, and next year he'll publish another book about the famous Ganelda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossbourne on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Always a great promo. Thank you very much. Our book, Movers and Mavericks, is selling like hot tamales, and thank you again for mentioning it. Well, Ronnie, tonight we are privileged to have two guests this evening. Our first guest will be Mr. Evan Wright, co-author of the best-selling book titled American Desperado, My Life from Mafia Soldier to Cocaine Cowboy to Secret Government Asset, and Diane Ferrante, the wife of Seth Ferrante, author of The Supreme Team. The Supreme Team has gone down in street legend and lyrical lore of gangster rap as one of the most vicious gangs to ever emerge on the streets of New York. They inspired hip-hop culture and rap superstars like 50 Cent, Jay-Z, Biggie, Nas, and J. Rule. Evan Wright will discuss the remarkable life of John Roberts, his co-author. In the best-selling book titled American Desperado, Wright vividly describes the fascinating life of John Roberts, who was born into mafia royalty, witnessing his first murder at the age of 7, becoming a hunter-assassin in Vietnam, returning to New York to become, at 22, one of the city's leading nightclub impresarios, and then making his way down to Miami to become involved in the Medellin cartel as their cocaine transportation czar. It's going to be a great show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one. Well, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some of the mail we've received over the last couple of weeks, I'd like to thank our listeners out there for tuning into Crime Beat. There's no turning back the clock now, Ronnie. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program. We're averaging over 130,000 listeners every week, and now it's certainly something to cheer about. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artists First World Radio, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony, for making the show possible. Like I said many times, Ronnie, internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Now, just before we get on to the mailbag, Ron, you want to give our listeners out there in the wide, wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show.
Yes, next week we continue. The hits just keep coming. We have Kathy Lynn Austin, an expert on arms trafficking, peace and security, and founder of the Conflicts Awareness Project. Kathy became famous for taking down Victor Bout, who's the Pablo Escobar of arms trafficking, and a movie's being made starring Angelina Jolie, and you've heard of her, Willie, right?
Absolutely.
It's in the works, and she's got a book coming out. She hasn't got it out yet, but it's going to be a fascinating subject to discuss next week.
Yeah, it's going to be a great one. I'm looking forward to that one. The listeners, I'm sure, will get a good kick out of that show. Now, here is this week's mailbag. Hey, Ronnie, this one is from Carolyn Yerima of Toronto, Canada. She writes, I think your format is excellent. You guys speak very casually together, opening the show, and then on your closing, you use a recap method, again, very casually. Well-organized and a real treat to listen to. Your last show with Sylvia Longmire, author of Cartel, The Coming Invasion of Mexico's Drug Wars, was great. I can't believe how candid Sylvia speaks. Yikes, watch your back, girl. No trips to Mexico for us, writes Carolyn. Any remarks, Ronnie?
Yeah, who needs paid advertising? We've got listeners like that, right? Yeah, but, you know, Mexico, our guest pointed out that it always looks worse on television than it actually is. And I pointed out that I've reported from Northern Ireland, Nicaragua, Cuba, Bangladesh, it's pretty normal life out there. So, yeah. And she reassured us, and there's a lot of places in Mexico where our listeners can go.
Yeah, it's a great place to visit.
Right.
You got to just stay out of the trouble spots.
Right.
Now, this one is from Manny of El Paso, Texas, who writes, I think the United States government is part of the conspiracy of silence in not telling the American people the truth about the ghastly events that are happening on the U.S.-Mexican border. Your guest, Sylvia Longmire, deserves a hell of a lot of credit for exposing the drug war that's occurring only a few miles from where I live. Where is Obama and the other candidates for president on this subject? What are they afraid of? Hey, good comment, Ronnie.
Really,
Ronnie,
really good questions.
Remarks?
You know, we've heard a lot of our elected leaders. We haven't heard too much about drug trafficking in the American border. You know, many of them have been too busy demagoguing the immigration issue. And Sylvia Longmire's the interview with her last week really was an eye-opener to show the problems that the U.S. is inheriting from the war that's going on raging across the border in Mexico.
Absolutely. It's blood and guts down there, let me tell you. Now, just before we get on with our first featured guest, Mr. Evan Wright, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network, wherever you are tonight. We hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have a question for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you, and we'll try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, tonight's first guest is journalist Mr. Evan Wright, co-author of the book titled American Desperado, My Life from Mafia Soldier to Cocaine Cowboy to Secret Government Asset. Wright chronicles the life of John Roberts. Roberts would rise to become the Medellin cartel's most effective cocaine smuggler. The turn pager of a book is a fascinating look at one of the most audacious criminals in American history. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Evan Wright.
Thanks for having me.
Right. We're sorry that John Roberts couldn't be here. Our listeners should be aware that he passed away December 28th. We're very sorry to hear the news.
Yes.
And but fortunately, in one way, I guess, he did see the book come out, right? Because the book came out in November.
Yeah, he saw it come out, and he actually did some radio interviews about it early on, which made him very happy. But, you know, a lot of people are probably happy he's dead because he was an evil, rotten person, too.
Right. Well, you know, he was 63 years old when he passed away, but, you know, if you read your book, which is a page-turner of a read, he lived several lifetimes. I mean, and the characters that populate the book are just amazing. There's CIA, Republican Party, Pablo Escobar, John Gotti, Jimi Hendrix, Meyer Lansky.
So, and Democrats, too.
Right. I mean, so... Democrats, too?
Yeah, okay. Not just Republican Party. There's Democrats in it, too.
Okay, this guy covered all bases, right?
Yes.
On that. Well, I mean, you know, he lived several lifetimes, and... as you say, he wasn't a nice guy. I mean, you know, he liked to beat up people. He wasn't too nice towards women. So why did you decide to collaborate with John Robert with John and do the book?
I kind of liked him. It's interesting because he was the thing that I liked about him was he was so honest about what a rotten person he was. And he also, it was not baloney. He had, late in life, he fathered a son, and he went to a lot of trouble to try to be a good father. I don't know if he was a good father, but he was certainly trying. And that little grain of trying to be a good person in him kind of fascinated me. So that was my initial attraction to doing a book with him.
Right. Well, I mean, you have your choice of books. You're a very distinguished journalist. I mean, you did a great book in Generation Kill. You're a contributing writer to Vanity Fair, which I subscribe to on that. And so I guess in one way, he was quite lucky to get you and probably worked with you realizing that.
Yeah, maybe I don't know if he thought that, but he liked Generation Kill, I do know that. But I always pick projects based on what interests me, when I can do that. Mm-hmm. And I was able to go down to Florida. I spent 3 years on and off working on the book, mm-hmm. and I stayed with John at his house. Mm-hmm. So I got this inside glimpse of, how an aging criminal was leading his life, and it was just, I don't know, it was always like a new day for me when I was there.
Right. And our listeners are probably familiar with Cocaine Cowboys, and John Roberts mm-hmm. is a star of that. And I guess you've seen Cocaine Cowboys, right? And
yes.
How accurate is that? Is that depiction of John Roberts in there?
Well, I'm friends with Billy Corbin right. and Alfred Spellman, who made that documentary. And we've talked a lot about how accurate all of it is, from what the cops told them to what they told me to Mickey Munday, who was John's mm-hmm. sort of technical guru
mm-hmm.
and who can't be left out of any account of what John did. And it's hard, everybody who survived that era became a storyteller. And like all storytellers, you sometimes have to check what they're telling you.
That is true.
And so I thought that the Cocaine Cowboys was pretty accurate.
Mm-hmm.
What I did that was different in the book, which you guys probably noticed, is I tried to footnote
mm-hmm.
when John made different claims about different things. If I could find evidence proving it, I put it in there. When I found evidence disproving it, I would put it in there too.
Right. Well, some of the stories are amazing. Like there's a story in there about, John Gotti. He almost went to war.
Mm-hmm.
Or some kind of dispute, and he finally reached a compromise. There's a story about Meyer Lansky and a hit. And I mean, how do you verify these stories?
Well, the different phases of John's life. The New York Times wrote about John in 1971, I believe. I quote some of the article in the book. So in that time, according to the New York Times and John was implicated in a crime then, and he was rolling with what the New York Times described as top mafia capos. One of them was his uncle.
Mm-hmm.
So his general credibility about what he was doing in New York
mm-hmm.
in that time, he was, running, taking over nightclubs on behalf mm-hmm. of the mafia and running them
mm-hmm.
and, extorting money from the owners.
Mm-hmm.
That's verified generally by the New York Times. And then I actually interviewed a couple different people from that time who knew him.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
that's really interesting. Everything about this guy is interesting. Take his name, for example. I mean, his name is Roberts, but, his father was what, Nat Riccobono? And it was
yes.
a Sicilian name. So how does a guy that's Sicilian get a name like Roberts?
Yeah, well, his story was that when his father was deported, and there's evidence that his father was Nat Riccobono, and he was deported after the Appalachian Conference.
Mm-hmm. Oh, in 57.
Yeah, he was deported a year or two later,
mm-hmm.
and there were a bunch of Italians that were deported around then. And John and his sister, who I also interviewed,
mm-hmm.
said that after that, their mother remarried, but not to a man named Roberts. But she told John, you have to change your father's last name, because the name Riccobono was in the papers a lot back
mm-hmm.
then. And John, in 1960 or 61, was a big fan of Bonanza.
Mm-hmm.
And
Purnell Roberts.
Purnell Roberts was the son, and John idolized him. So his full name is John Purnell Roberts.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's his legal name.
But he was a Sicilian at heart too, because he was one mean mother, right?
Yes, and of course we don't want to generalize against Sicilians. And there's a school, as the author and somebody, I've debated this so much with cops who arrested John. We believe he's Sicilian. We believe his father was Riccobono. However, there's a minority report of thought that the Italians were working closely with the Jewish gangsters.
Right.
There's one or two people who said, hey, John was never, he's not Italian, he was actually Jewish. And his father was a Jewish gangster. Now, I know that in 71, the New York Times identified him as John Riccobono. So I believe he's Italian, but there's a part of me as a journalist that, unless I see the blood test off of, people claim that possibly he is a Jewish gangster.
Right. Well, to continue our politically incorrect conversation here, his father was a piece of work too. He's quoted as telling John, evil is stronger than good after he shoots a guy, right?
Yeah.
in a traffic incident. Tell us about that and what kind of impact it had on John.
Well, it was, it's what a great childhood story. John, because the fuller story is that his father would collect money from black bars in New Jersey, doing the numbers game for
right.
the mafia, right?
Right.
And his dad would drive around in I forget if it was a Buick. I don't think it was a Cadillac. It was some big old American car, right, in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, his driver was a boxer named Mr. Tut,
right.
who was a black guy. And John, instead of going to school, Mr. Tut and his dad would drive him around to the bars in New Jersey
right.
and pick up the money. Now, in the book, John goes into how his dad would then hook up with some of the women in the bars, and he'd have to sit there with Mr. Tut drinking Coke while his dad was in a back room with the ladies.
Mm-hmm.
All of that's going on. And one day, his father was in a bad mood, and they were driving in a rural part of New Jersey, which did exist then, and there was a narrow bridge, and the guy wouldn't get out of the way in the other car. So John's father stepped out of the car and went to the bridge and shot the other driver.
Oh, wow.
And he and Mr. Tut then pushed the driver aside and rolled the car back and went on.
Right. Is this why John didn't seem to have any critical criminal inhibitions? He was apprehended by police for kidnapping?
Is that true?
I mean, and what age did this happen?
17.
17. So that incident taught him a lesson, I guess, in some way, right?
What his father told him through actions and words was that evil is stronger than good.
Mm-hmm.
If you're ever in a position of weakness, choose the evil path and you'll come out on top.
And he followed it.
But the interesting thing about John is he was not a dummy. And, he thought a lot about this and analyzed whether it was right or wrong morally, and also whether it was right or wrong in terms of efficaciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And, later in life with his son, he determined that, what's a greater value is just loving his son. But, yeah, that was his value. And so the book is, every time he has a problem, he thinks of the most evil thing to do, and he comes out on top. And,
right. Well, he served in Vietnam and, was injured there, right? And and he left the service, ended up in New York, and then somehow ended up to Miami. Just talk about how he ended up in Miami and sort of gravitated towards the drug trade, because we could go on for 5 hours with this guy. I mean, we're not even touching the surface in this interview.
There was a string of club murders in New York with club owners. There's a string of murders, one with a club owner and a few other people. John, that's why he was in the New York Times in 71. He was implicated in the murders. And according to him and several people, the mafia was really upset with him because he was bringing a lot of heat down.
Mm-hmm.
And so he fled to Miami to stop causing trouble in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And when he arrived in Miami, which really wasn't until 73 approximately,
mm-hmm.
He was like laying low so much that he got a job as a gardener.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent several months just digging, you know, tree lawns and putting in tree lawns and planting trees.
Right.
And very quickly hooked up with, when he felt safe again, he hooked up with some local mafia Italians down there. But the more and he started dealing cocaine, just mm-hmm. small levels. And he hadn't really done that in New York.
What year was this about?
73 to 74.
So it wasn't before the big rush, cocaine rush, you know, that came a little bit later.
It was before then. And the interesting thing is he looked at cocaine as like an upwardly mobile drug because
mm-hmm.
the people who bought it were at country clubs.
Mm-hmm.
They were rich. They weren't in ghettos. They weren't dirty hippies. John hated hippies. And and he started dealing it. Now, he hooked up with a Cuban named Albert San Pedro,
mm-hmm.
Cuban-American, lived
right.
in Hialeah. And San Pedro could get the cocaine, but he lived in this, like, poor, working-class, Cuban, mm-hmm. you know, white person neighborhood near the airport. Nobody was buying it there. So John and an Italian named Gary Terriaca, who actually belonged to some fancy clubs down there, mm-hmm. country clubs, they started selling it in the rich areas. And this little business that they started really began to expand in the mid-70s.
Wow.
They moved, one of John and Gary had a friend who was like a rich ski bum who lived in Aspen, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
He moved out there. By 1981, jumping ahead, their guy in Colorado was moving at times up to 100 kilos a month.
Wow.
But by that time, in 81, John was no longer a distributor, really, in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
He had linked up with the Ochoa family. And the Ochoas in the Medellin cartel were really like the owners of the cartel.
Right.
And Pablo Escobar, who's kind of more famous, I think,
right.
isn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yes, very.
Yeah, and, you know, but Pablo Escobar really was kind of a rival of the Ochoas originally, and then he allied with them. But he was never, according to John and other people, he was never like the owner of the cartel, as the Ochoas were,
right.
who were a rich, politically connected family. So John hooked up with them. And the turning point in his story is when he met this guy, Mickey Monday,
mm-hmm.
who was like a Florida cracker type guy. And I've spent a lot of time with Mickey. Mickey's this big, blonde-haired guy, family's originally from Ohio. And Mickey doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, doesn't swear. His mom died a year ago, and he, you know, he lived with her for years.
Mm-hmm.
A church-going lady.
Mm-hmm.
But Mickey was a genius at modifying anything that floats, rolls, or flies. And he could, you know, make these planes go really fast, carry much heavier loads, make the go-fast boats, but disguise them so they didn't look like the racing boats that the
mm-hmm.
Coast Guard were after. He built radios to listen in on the Coast Guard and customs communication
mm-hmm.
systems. And it was really Mickey who outfoxed the government.
Right.
But John was the one who, sort of like in a company, John would have been like on the sales force.
Right.
You know,
right.
he got along with the Colombians.
Mm-hmm.
He could deal with Mickey's technical guys.
Mm.
And, you know, everybody claims to be a different, you know, from the 80s, everybody claims they're the biggest this or that drug dealer. But when the U.S. government finally got around to indicting John and Mickey and Max Mermelstein,
mm-hmm.
another important partner,
right.
the government identified John and Max as the American representatives of the cartel.
Right.
And the estimates are that they smuggled in between, you know, $2 and $15 billion worth of cocaine.
Wow, wow. Well, you know, Max Mermelstein was very very important in the history of the Colombian drug trade. He wrote a book called The Man Who Made of Snow, right?
Yeah.
And which I read, and I thought it was an excellent book. But you know, Monday, I guess it was like Monday's ingenuity and Robert's balls, right? That made this collaboration work. But Monday didn't seem to like Roberts because he was so flashy, you know, and so extravagant. He was supposedly, you know, spend millions of dollars on nothing, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, John had, you know, it was crazy. He had a dog that got into, John loves dogs or loved dogs, and one of his dogs got into a fight with an alligator, and his teeth were broken off, so he had like a cokehead dentist put in gold implants.
Right.
He had like all, like every drug dealer in Miami, he had like cougars and stuff. In his
he had a 200-pound cougar, didn't he?
Yes. And
he slept with it. He slept with it too, didn't he?
He slept with it, and I have pictures of that. We didn't put him in the book, but you know, John was unusual. He wasn't like the typical like Scarface type guy. Like he had a really interesting girlfriend, Toni Moon, who was a model. But they both loved horses and animals.
Right.
So he actually built this big, kind of funky ranch in Del Rey, which was the Styx, and had these animals and, you know, race horses.
Right.
He was big in race in that industry, but he really loved horses. And they had a really crazy life up there. I met some jockeys who used to work for him. And, yeah, one of the jockeys was almost eaten by the cat at one point.
Well, Evan, let's take a break. Willie, let's take a break here for station identification, and we'll be back with our incredibly interesting story of John Roberts, American Desperado.
You
Go
bet.
Ahead, Willie.
Thanks, Ronnie. That's a great, what an intriguing story. What a great guest. Very fascinating. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Harib. Now back to Ron and Mr. Evan Wright.
Thank you. We're back with Evan Wright, who's the co-author with John Roberts, who passed away, of American Desperado. That's John Roberts' story. And the subtitle is From Mafia Soldier to Cocaine Cowboy to Secret Government Asset. And it's published by Random House. And you go to www.randomhouse.com. Any other websites, Evan, that our listeners can go to get more information about your book and buy it?
Well, they can't buy it off this site, but I belong to Goodreads. It's like a book lover's website. I don't sell books on it, but there's more information on the book there and on my writing. So.
Right. And you have a Facebook page, a Twitter?
No, none of those.
Oh, none of those. You're pretty low-key then.
Yeah, I believe it's a corporate conspiracy to steal our souls, but...
I think you're right.
Well, you know...
I actually wish I was on those and I had lots of followers.
Right.
I've never gotten around to doing it. So.
Right. Well, before we deal with these interesting background of John Roberts, where did the 6'6" professional wrestler called The Thing sleep? That was his bodyguard.
Yes, that
the
was
thing. I like that. The Thing.
His name was Brian. And again, with John, you know, he would tell these stories. And at first, I was like, "Come on, that can't be true." And I got a picture of Brian the Thing, and I interviewed one of his friends. Brian, not surprisingly, died of steroid-related complications 2 years ago. But yeah, Brian was his bodyguard, and had actually originally also, while being a locally renowned pro wrestler who was loved by kids apparently, did debt collection for the mafia too before he was with John.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that was one of his the people in his life.
Well, right. Well, you know, we could spend about an hour talking about his friends, and he had some really interesting ones. Richard Pryor, right? Jimi Hendrix?
Yeah.
O.J. Simpson? Take your best shot at the best story of those three.
Look,
we won't have a chance to talk about all three.
You can't top O.J. Simpson simply because he came to John's house and wouldn't leave. He was doing so much coke, and John really didn't like him, and he couldn't get rid of him. And it's when O.J. was playing in Buffalo, you know. So they had to, John and his friends had to take him to the airport, and he was so coked out. He couldn't walk, so they put him in a wheelchair and were pushing him through the airport. And this was right at the same time when O.J.'s commercials were on for Hertz. And
he was running to the airport?
They were saying, like, go, O.J., go, as they're pushing him in this wheelchair, drunk and coked out. So
right.
That's my favorite story.
Well, he did meet, you know, the boss of bosses, so to speak, of the drug trade, Pablo Escobar, right?
He did. And
what was his impression?
You know what? He always described meeting Pablo as like, you know, when you're like out in the field office and the headquarters says you've got to come and have a meeting with the boss because he has a great idea for you and it's always going to suck. And he described Pablo Escobar that way. He thought that Pablo, at least in his contacts, was a very joyless person and was paranoid and unhappy when he was with him. So that was his take on Pablo.
Right. He didn't have a sense of humor, right? Well, he was killing all those people that he was killing.
He also, you know, insisted that when they went to Colombia, that he also met Pablo in Panama at times. But when they were in Colombia, Pablo insisted on showing him, like, the soccer fields he was building.
Right.
Like, John thought of him as kind of a politician, actually.
Well, he did. He wanted to run for politics. He wanted for politics, and he was an alternate, right?
Yeah, I think he actually won.
Yeah, and he won us until they exposed him, and he went underground on that. But you mentioned Noriega, and that's very interesting because even Noriega shows up in John Roberts' biography. What's the connection to General Noriega?
Noriega laundered money for the cartels.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, it's not a conspiracy or anything. Mm-hmm. What happened is the CIA sort of gave him some banks in mm-hmm. Panama that were sort of like Swiss banks. Hard
right.
to tell what the transactions were. And the mm-hmm. CIA used Noriega's banks to funnel money to the Contras and other guerrilla groups that they were involved in.
Mm-hmm.
On the side, it wasn't a government CIA conspiracy,
right.
but on the side, Noriega used those same banks to launder money for the cartels.
Mm-hmm.
John, working for the Medellin cartel, helped bring their money, their cash, to those banks, and also put a lot of his own money into Noriega's banks.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the CIA, right? Because they tried to co-opt him, right?
Yeah, they did. I couldn't go into all of it, but if anybody reads the book, you know, when people come to me with CIA stories, I tend not to believe them. So I very carefully noted what I could find out about John's story, and he did definitely have a lot of contact mm-hmm. with a CIA officer, a future CIA officer named Rick Prado.
Right.
And I got a quick. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I've got a quick question, Evan. Speaking of the CIA, John Roberts is described as a hunter assassin in Vietnam. Was that part of a CIA thing that he was involved in? Well, just to describe what that means, hunter-assassin. How many kills did he have over there?
Well, let me say this about the CIA and then about Vietnam.
Sure.
There's very good linkage to John and the CIA and one of the pilots he is, Barry Seal, that basically John and Barry Seal were used to shuttle military transport planes to Central America filled with guns for the Contras. That's very easy to establish. The Vietnam stuff, according to John, you know, he wasn't in any special unit. He was in the 101st, and they had a long-range reconnaissance patrol program, which were sort of equivalent to special forces. And they were called LRRPs, L-R-R-Ps, but pronounced LRRPs. And those guys, John's unit, had a lot of latitude to go out and hunt and kill people. And they had a specific mission, which was to monitor firefights from a distance between Americans and the Vietnamese and try to discern where the Vietnamese leadership was going after those fights. And they were supposed to hunt them down, kill them, and locate their arms caches and call in fire support on them. So generally the mission, as he described it, was very... He's sort of special forces, but very standard operating procedure for Vietnam. I interviewed some people who were in LRRPs and described similar experiences. But the only asterisk to the Vietnam part of his story, and since I've covered the military and I have a lot of respect for them, and John describes committing mm-hmm. war atrocities,
mm-hmm.
I could not locate the records of his service at the National Archives. And I'm still trying. So I put a note in the book, I can't locate those records. Now, on the plus side, to support his story, John did have the injuries to his head where he said he was hit by enemy fire. And other witnesses, you know, friends and family, described him coming back from Vietnam. But it's the part of his story that I found the sketchiest in terms of substantiation.
Right. Well, we've only got a couple minutes, and we're not going to touch on the Republican Party or somewhere, even the...
he was a big donor to the Republicans.
Oh, yeah, he didn't like hippies, so I guess he was a big donor to Republicans. And he did become a snitch. and that's a little controversial. But I'm just wondering, did he have any regrets about his life? I mean, did he actually kill somebody along the way? And did he have any regrets about that and anything else that happened?
No, not really. And the thing about the book, and if you go to Amazon, it's funny, there's comments of people who are like, this is the worst book I've ever read. And the reason people react to it, I think, unless maybe it is the worst book they've read, is that unlike, and I read a lot of these sort of gangster confessional books.
Right.
A lot of times, I think the co-author, the guy doing my job, will try to put in something like, yeah, I killed all these people, but I'm really sad about it today.
Right.
The readers feel more comfortable.
Right.
John, he expresses a few regrets in the book,
right,
but they're very qualified. And, you know, the thing that God bless him, he always said, I'm a sociopath. You know, he didn't try to, right, it wasn't an excuse. It was just like a self-assessment.
Right.
And so that's who he is. That's what's in the book. And that's why some people hate it and some people like it.
Right. Right. Well, what about the snitching? How far did that go? I mean, it's kind of nebulous there. You know, people accuse him of stuff. Well, what did he actually do?
Well, yeah. First of all, the whole that's another thing about him. He and Mickey were snitched out by Max Mermelstein. You know,
right,
that's what brought about their arrest. Mm-hmm. When he did not snitch initially. He jumped bond. He fled for 6 years. So did Mickey.
Mm-hmm.
When they were both finally rearrested 6 years later, mm-hmm, after a wild adventure John had in Mexico, he gave them up. He gave them initially the Meyer Lansky murder, and he snitched out a guy named Rick Prado, who was then working for the CIA,
mm-hmm,
and another gangster named Robert Era, who was separately indicted at the time for something else, and pled guilty to something else. And that was the big thing he gave them, but the government never, strangely enough, and the book goes into this a little more,
mm-hmm,
that was sort of an ingenious snitch, because what he did is he gave the government a CIA officer, who at the time was highly decorated.
Right.
Federal prosecutors believed him sufficiently, and there was a branch of federal prosecutors who wanted to indict that CIA officer for murder.
Right.
So they gave him a massive sentence reduction.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, the government never used that information.
Wow.
So he basically snitched out Rick Prado, and it was never used. He also offered to snitch out General Noriega, and
right,
they didn't use it because Noriega was actually nearing the end of his trial.
Right.
And I believe in 2006, for motives that I don't know why, he snitched out a mafioso in New York. And it's an ongoing case, so I won't talk about it. But there is, those are the three instances. The one in the first two in the 90s, I can sort of, first of all, who know that code of like not snitching, I think it's mostly BS. But if there is a code, his snitches in the 90s were sort of within the margins.
Right.
You know, one guy worked for the government anyway.
Right.
But the one in 2006, I don't know what his motives were, if it's true.
Right. Well, we're finishing up here. We just got to come. Briefly, I want to talk about this a little bit more, but tell us about the movie. And I understand Mark Wahlberg, which is, you know, the A-list of Hollywood, is on board to play John Roberts.
That's what I hear, too. I actually wrote the script originally for Paramount. But what happened is Wahlberg and Peter Berg, the director, they both saw The Cocaine Cowboys, the documentary, totally loved it. And when I started the book, they came to me through, you know, representatives and said, you know, would you write the movie? We want to do this movie. And I got involved with them. The movie's been in development now for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Wahlberg keeps giving interviews saying he's going to make it, but I don't know when he's going to make it.
That's Hollywood, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's, you know, most movies take years. People don't realize they take years and years to get off the ground on that. And one last question.
Wait, I have to tell you a story quickly.
Oh, please. We got about 20, 30 seconds.
Peter Berg, the director, who just is coming out with Battleship.
Right.
Was such an outstanding guy. He actually went to Miami 6 months ago when John was dying and stayed with him for 3 days,
mm-hmm,
and just to sort of absorb who he was. But I
right.
thought it was for a Hollywood kind of guy, I thought it was, like, pretty amazing.
Well, that really is, and we really appreciate you having on the show. We ran out of time, but you know, we just touched the surface of your book, so our listeners got to get this book, American Desperado, by Random House, by Evan Wright and the late John Roberts, and it's everywhere, right?
It's everywhere, and I want to listen to your next guest talk about the Supremes. It's going to be a great interview.
Right, right, on that, then. Thank you very much, then, and we will hopefully have you back on the show because your career is taking off, right?
Anytime. It was a real pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure for us.
Okay, take care.
Okay, thank you, then. And let's take a station break, and we're going to hook up with our next guest, Diane Ferrente, and we'll be back in a second.
And again, thanks very much to Evan Wright. What a great interview. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hered. Now, our second guest this evening is Diane Ferrente, wife of the award-winning author Seth Ferrente, who is currently serving a 25-year prison sentence for LSD trafficking. Diane Ferrente will talk about her husband's fascinating book titled The Supreme Team. It's going to be a great interview, so stick around. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. Diane?
Now back to Crime Beat with your hosts, Ron and Will.
Right. We're back with Diane Ferrente,
yep.
The wife of Seth Ferrente, who's the author of Supreme Team. And, of course, you know from previous broadcasts that Seth can't be here. He's in prison and has been there since 1994, but he's turned out to be a very good writer. He's published several books. So we invited Diane on the show. Welcome to the show, Diane.
Hi.
Great. How long have you and Seth been married?
It's going to be 7 years this year.
Right.
But
well,
he's been in prison since 93.
Right. Well, that's interesting. How did you meet?
Well, he lived in St. Louis, and he lived in this house that with
right.
some other guys, and one of them my sister was going out with, and she told me that there's a guy over there that I would like. So, and when I met him, I knew him. I didn't know him as Seth. He was still under his alias.
Right.
As a fugitive.
Right. Well, he'll be getting out in a couple of years, so you're probably climbing walls, right?
Yeah. Hopefully by the end of next year or early 2014.
Right. I've corresponded with Seth, and he's called me several times. I know he's got big plans. I always admire his ambition. He wants to get a PhD. He's got a master's. He's done writing. When did he get started in writing?
Well, it was when he was in, he worked in the rec, and he wrote for, like, a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in Fort Dix, and some of the guys from Harlem liked what he wrote about for the basketball teams, and then they contacted their Don Diva, Kevin Childs,
because right.
he was starting the magazine, and he started writing for them.
Right, right. Don Diva is a real a popular hip-hop magazine, and
right.
Seth has written for the hip-hop community on that. In fact, his book, Supreme Team, is related to that subject. How did this book get started, the Supreme Team?
Well, it's something that Seth, he was in, when he was in Glenville and Gilmer.
Right.
He was with Supreme, and so Supreme blessed him to write some, you know, the Don Diva story he
right.
did with
right.
the two of them.
Right.
And then also for the chapter he did on him in Street Legends Volume 1.
Right.
And then... he said, Supreme said that he was going to need a voice, you know,
right.
later on, so since then he's been wanting to write the story, so
right
for about 5 years.
Right. And so he's been working on it for 5 years.
Right.
Right on that. Now, you're talking about Supreme. There's two main characters, right, involved with this, the two leaders of the Supreme team, Kenneth Supreme McGriff.
Right.
And then his nephew, Gerald Prince Miller. And, you know, to tell you, I knew a little bit about the subject, and from what I read of Seth's book, these were two mean guys. I mean, these weren't choir boys. I mean, they were involved in some vicious stuff in New York City. Tell us about the gang and how it got started, and what are some of the things that they did. They're from the south side of Jamaican Queens, right?
Right. Well, it was started as a group of 5 percenters from the south side of Jamaica, and they got into the drug game in the early 80s, and then eventually became the first and the largest crack-dealing gang in New York. And they recruited Spanish members as well as black members to, deal with the Colombians to get all the coke. So, actually, Supreme is more of a, he was more diplomatic, and Prince was more of the, his right-hand man, and Prince was in charge of the security, and it said that he was the deadly force and the gunslinger.
Right, right. So. But it's quite interesting story. I mean, 50 Cent, there's a 50 Cent connection, right? He was supposed to have been a low-level crack dealer with the gang. Was that true?
Well, he was. He drops their names in like the Ghetto Koran. He calls Prince the businessman and. Prem the businessman and Prince the killer. So
right, right.
He names dropped some of the members.
Right, and that's what got him shot, right? He was shot 9 times, reportedly, because of making those references.
Right, so, But like a lot of the hip-hop back in that day, they were all influenced by the street members.
Right, right, on that sort of thing. But, a lot of the gangs didn't end up shooting, rap singers.
Right.
On that sort of thing. But they were instrumental in the birth of hip-hop, right?
Right.
And they were, they ushered in the crack era for whatever that's worth. What does Seth say about that? What kind of impact did they have on the hip-hop?
Well, it was the money that was made from the crack trade that financed a lot of the early hip-hop recordings.
Right.
It was the criminal groups like the Supreme Team that underwrote the cost of the parties where these artists performed. And basically, in essence, they funded the beginning of what became hip-hop culture through their drug dealings. And,
right.
And the rappers watched them and emulated them, and brought their style and swagger.
Right, right. How long did the gang operate?
Supreme got busted in by the feds in 87.
Mm-hmm.
And then Prince and the rest of the team a couple of years later on a RICO Act. So I would say from the early part of the 80s till the late 80s.
Right. Seth writes that their ruthless ways brought them down. He doesn't pull any punches on that. In what way did their ruthless ways? Did they become just too violent and they're involved in too much killings and eventually caught up with them?
I know what you're getting at, but there was a lot of they were known to shoot first and ask questions later.
Right.
So, and that's again because Prince handled everything with gunplay, and he didn't play when it came to the team security.
Right, right. Now, what about they went to trial, right? And was it an open and shut case? For both of them, in terms of being found guilty?
Well, Supreme was found guilty on a shoot-for-hire case, so, they're both doing life in prison, so.
Right, right. Well, where are they being incarcerated?
Well, Supreme's at USP Lee, and Prince is at, I think, Allenwood?
Right.
FCI?
Right. Did Seth, your husband, get their collaboration on this project? They was able to interview some of the gang members.
Yeah, how he does it, he usually goes through court records and newspaper articles, and then he interviews the people involved, like their homeboys and the co-defendants.
They're mostly in prison, right? These homeboys, and I mean, he can't call outside of prison,
right?
You know, to making long distance calls because he only got 15 minutes, right? So he has to do most of the research in prison. Is that correct?
Right, and then he has me do it. So
right. Well, what do you do? I mean, on the projects, what do you go to the courthouse or? And do you interviews and transcribe them? How do you get involved with the project?
Well, Seth usually tells me what he's looking for, and then I'll look at it online.
Right.
And he does a lot because they have extensive law libraries, you know, in prison. So.
Right, right.
I got a quick question for Diane. Diane, you mentioned you were married 7 years ago to Seth. Were you married in the facility?
Right.
I see. How often do you see Seth, say, in a year? Tell our listeners that part of your story.
Well, let's see. He moved closer. He's in Arkansas now, so I go about, you know, once a month to visit him.
How far are you from Seth now?
About 5 hours.
Oh, that's pretty good.
But before, he was always on the East Coast, and it would take, 12, 15 hours away. So.
Right.
So then, back then, I would only see him maybe 3 times a year.
Right. And now, when you visit him, can he give you information to share information about what he wants in the books and all that, or how do you handle that? Is it email? Yeah, I know he has access to email because he emails me regularly.
Right.
Through you, I guess, right?
Yeah, and then I email you.
And then you email me, right?
Right.
Right, on that sort of thing. But I mean, how do you get the information to him so that he can use it to do his research?
Well, I mail it.
Mail it. So
right.
it's a time-consuming project.
It is.
Right? Even though he's in prison, and I guess you would think he would have all the time in the world, it's still time-consuming.
It takes a lot.
Right.
And then plus, there's so many restrictions in prison. You have to worry
right.
about the mail.
Right. Well, that's interesting because we were trying to get Seth on the air, and he was thrown into the hole. For a while, for whatever reason, on that, and I know this. We had other guests, and I've talked to people. They tend to frown. The authorities tend to frown on inmates improving themselves, you know, through their written word, right?
Right.
You know why? I mean, and is that still happening with Seth?
It usually happens right when he gets to a new prison. They really, they just don't. For whatever reason it is, they just don't.
Right. Right. But so he's got to watch himself, right? I guess because it's very
right.
easy to to cross the authorities and get into trouble on that sort of thing. So what do you do when you get the research done? Did you help him edit the book and how do you publish it? How does that process work?
Well, he'll get all the information, type it up, and then send it to me, and then I scan it, and
right.
then I'll mail it back to him, and then he makes all his corrections, and then I enter it, and then. Send it back to him. So it's a lot of back and forth.
Right, on that sort of thing. So Seth got, how long did you say, again, before he is released?
Well,
I know he's in the lowest, right, category?
Right.
Of incarceration. So when will he get out?
Well, the lowest is camp, and I don't think he's going to go to a camp because he was a fugitive. So
Right,
they
yeah.
They probably won't let him go to a camp.
Right.
But he's hoping the end of, like around November 2013 or the beginning of 2014,
he'll be out. And that, and I know he's got big plans. Tell us about them. Tell us about your plans. Do your personal plans with him.
Yeah, I can't wait to go pick him up.
Well, what are you gonna do when you pick him up? I mean, well, sort of. But I mean, like, you have a really big dinner, or what does he want to do when he gets out? You know, he's been 24 years behind bars. What does he want? I know he's probably dreamt about what he wanted to do besides seeing you. What does he want to do?
Well, I mean, eventually he wants to make films because he's been writing screenplays. So, and he wants all these stories, visualized in the film or a feature-length film, movie.
Right. I know he's got a screenplay of Supreme, he told me, based on the book.
Right.
And but I guess it's pretty hard to market that while he's in prison. He's going to have to wait, right?
Yeah, but he does a lot of, I mean, he sends out a lot of stuff.
Right,
so.
Right. On that, then. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, and finally talking to you, Diane.
Uh-huh.
And let's talk about where we can get the book. It's you have a website.
Right.
GorillaConvict.com, right?
Right. You can buy the book, and it's also available in e-books.
Right. It's available in e-books, so go to GorillaConvict.com, and you can order the book, and it'll be shipped to you, right? And the name of the book, again, is The Supreme Team, right?
Right.
On that, then. And there are several other books of Seth that are there, and I've got copies of them, and I've read them. And there's no better writer in America writing about the urban gangster. And every guy's got to have a woman like you, Diane.
Yeah. I've basically been, holding him down this whole time.
Right. Willie, you got anything to say to Diane before we leave?
Well, I just have to say, Diane, you've got a lot of patience. You put true meaning on behind that Tammy Wynette's classic country tune,
yeah.
Stand By Your Man.
Right.
Way to go.
Yeah.
Way to go.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. We'll get you back on the show later when Seth has another book coming out.
Okay.
Have a great evening.
All right, you too.
And say hello to Seth for us.
I will. All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye.
Wow, great. Great interview. That's great. Thanks, Ronnie, and thanks again to our very special guests, Diane Ferrante and Evan Wright. We're privileged to have them on our program. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about our interviews tonight?
Wow, I mean, John Roberts and Seth Ferrante, that was just really amazing. I mean, John died at a relatively young age, but he lived an incredible life. And I think Evan Wright has done an amazing job of bringing John's story to life. And, of course, Diane, you said it all. Stand By Your Man, right? She's given new meaning to that. How about you, Willie?
Well, you know what? Getting back to John Roberts, I learned that he was a quintessential desperado in every sense of the word, man. How he wasn't ever bumped off was an example of how shrewd, cunning, and adaptable this guy really was.
Mm-hmm.
His life is a movie. I hope it comes off. What a great
movie. Right, I can hardly wait to see it.
Absolutely. Now, hey, Ronnie, we forgot to tell our listeners what you're doing, what you'll be doing in the next couple of weeks with John, with Matthews.
Right, we got time, right? I'll summarize it briefly, and I'll give you more detail next week. The documentary is coming out in about 2 weeks, we've been getting an amazing response to that, and we've got some books coming out by authors like John O'Connor. I tell our listeners to go to strategicmediabooks.com for more information about our books and DVDs.
Great. Willie? Well, we're really looking forward to that. I'm sure everybody is. Now, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for February 23rd, where we'll have as our very special guest, Miss Kathy Lynn Austin, Executive Director of Conflict Awareness Project. For almost 20 years, she's carried out an extensive field investigations into the illegal trade in weapons. It's going to be a great show. Also, we're thrilled to announce the appearance of Lou Diaz, a former guest and author of the fascinating book titled Dancing with the Devil. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss this one. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to our Crime Beat archive page. Wherever you are tonight, we would like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chepsik and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.